This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey guys, welcome to the show. Eric Anderson, Editor-in-Chief of Awards Watch, is with us. Our gang of two is back. Thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks for having me. Let's get on it.
Let's get on it. So you haven't conceded to anyone or anything this week?
I have nothing to concede to. I won. I won the election.
You did. Okay. Well, I'll just make a note of that for next time. Anyway, lovely to talk to you. Let's start with the news from the trenches this past few weeks since we talked last. There's been some big news. I wanted to start with the Wonder Woman news. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it's what people were expecting, and Warner Brothers has been really kind of cagey about how they were going to manage anything from a fall or winter slate. They had already pulled Dune off for next year. They hadn't at this point had any information on Judas and the Black Messiah, like a date or what they were going to do with that. So this last week, they announced that they would do a simultaneous release of Wonder Woman 1984 in theaters and on HBO Max same day on Christmas Day, which is pretty, it's unheard of, kind of. But at the same time, in the era of closed theaters and COVID and everything that's happening, I don't know how much can be unheard of anymore.
Right.
So I think the expectation and the hope was that this was going to happen. But they needed to see more examples of it pretty clearly before they were going to do it themselves.
So what's unheard of is the fact that it's the same day.
Yeah. Yes. So what other studios are attempting to do is still a bit of a theatrical window, even if it's only like 2 weeks long. And, you know, it's the right thing to do because, you know, we just had another round of theater closures in LA because of spiking again. It's going to continue. It's not just going to stop, you know, on January 1st or January 20th for that matter. So studios have to make these decisions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think we've talked about this before, that when you have these $200 million movies, there really then is no way to recoup the cost of those if you are just going to go to your streaming platform. And HBO Max, as great as a platform it is, because it has such a phenomenal library of films, have still run into a lot of issues of...
It was a really bad rollout.
It was a really bad rollout, which is tragic because, like I said, it's a fantastic lineup of content that they have. And it constantly missed the mark. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So hopefully, and I know they're hoping, that this announcement is going to bring in a whole bunch of new subscribers. Maybe you remember too, when the whole rollout of HBO Max was happening and, you know, your HBO Go was going to be, you know, shelved forever and it would turn into HBO Max, but people didn't know if they were getting it or if they had to pay for it if they were at HBO. It was really
so confusing. I remember
it was really disastrous. So, you know, they need to do a better job, and they're going to need a lot more new subscribers between now and Christmas to help offset the cost of something like Wonder Woman.
Right. How much does Warner Brothers, how much do you think they'll lose on this?
It's funny because it's not, you know, since it takes place in 1984, it's not like it's a movie that requires urgency for viewing. You could really hold this movie till whenever. But I think they also obviously had to look at the Tenet rollout and what happened with that, because worldwide, the numbers were pretty good. But obviously in the States, you know, it topped at like 50 million, and that was as best as it was going to be able to do. So I think they'll do okay with it. because there will be international numbers that will help offset the cost. But, you know, when you're talking about a movie costing $200 million, what you're really saying is that it costs $400 to $500 million when you include marketing and post-production costs. So in order to clear and become profitable, you know, it has to push into the $750 million. And no movie is able to make that right now.
And it's also interesting because the fact that they're doing theatrical at the same time must mean that they will be eligible for the Oscars.
Oh, absolutely. And I had taken Wonder Woman out of all of my predictions until they were going to make some kind of announcement. And then they did, and it's back in. So it's going to be one of the few big blockbuster type movies that was released this year and or in time. So I think it could do pretty well in those below the line categories.
Yeah, because besides Tenet, I mean, everyone else of those big blockbuster 200 million movies, they've all moved.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the international release of the film is actually the 16th, December 16th. So we'll see what that's going to look like before we get to Christmas Day.
Interesting. That's like the new world here. Anything else?
I'm hearing that Nomadland might do a very limited 1 week release in December. I think it's December 4th is the date that it had held on to. And then it's going to get pulled and not released wider until like February, like mid-February, which I think is a really big mistake. I think you're missing an opportunity for the average film goer to be able to see these movies before, you know, nominations and before Guild and Critics Awards come out, because this is the thing that always is frustrating for the casual viewer of the Oscars, is that mm-hmm. by the time they get to, you know, nominations or even the show, sometimes they're like, I've never heard of this movie.
I've never seen it.
I've never seen this, so why would I root for this movie?
So that means that Nomadland won't be going up on any streamers. I mean, it's even more difficult this year, the fact that most movie theaters won't have these movies. It's even more difficult than a typical year.
Well, this is another issue with, you know, a huge studio kind of falling behind on the ability to do something really smart and financially clever. And that's Disney has not created a section within Disney Plus for R-rated films and for adult fare that would just, you know, require a simple, you know, parental passcode or whatever it is that...
Yeah, because everything there has to be PG-13.
Yes, and there is no reason why that they could not do this for Nomadland and have their 20th Century and their Searchlight sections of Disney Plus, and that certain films are only accessible with... codes or whatever it is that they feel that they need to do. And then they would have it. Then they would have the opportunity to stream Nomadland earlier. I don't know why they don't do it.
Well, they can't think of everything.
I know, but they should. I mean, all they think about is money.
All the Baby Yoda merchandise that has to get out now.
which they also were behind on.
No.
Oh my God.
Well, let's move on. There's a few movies that are upcoming movies that I wanted to talk a little bit about because they're getting so much buzz that will be out soon. Most of them are Netflix or Disney Plus, but these are all on streamers, so you'll be able to see them. I wanted to get your thoughts on Mank.
I love Mank. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's It got a little more mixed response than I was expecting to. I think it got hit with a lot of the "it's cold" kind of comments, which I don't know what they were expecting. Maybe I don't know. I do think that Orson Welles fans will be really angry when they see it. Mm-hmm. Pauline Kael fans less so. but I really liked it. I think Amanda Seyfried is fantastic. I absolutely love her in it. I think Arliss Howard's amazing. I think Tom Pelfrey is great. Tom Pelfrey is an actor that as I was watching, and especially in near the end, you know, because it's shot in black and white and it's in mono sound to try and feel you know, like a 30s or 40s film. He could have been like a 30s or 40s actor with like, he was the only person actually that really like transported me into that place, as much as Amanda Seyfried was too.
Yeah, she was good, yeah.
But she's great. And we need a Marion Davies movie. Let's like just
I
her.
I know, that's the story. Now, I thought that was so interesting. It's a movie for me in every sense. I mean, I understand that it'll be a hard sell for anyone who hasn't seen Citizen Kane. I mean, I didn't find it cold at all. I found it to be just this loving portrait of cinema, an incredible story of credit, and you know, who gets credit on a movie, finally a movie about the screenwriter. It's about addiction, and also so timely with the whole fake news angle. Fincher perfection in every frame of the movie. So I mean, I understand that it's not for everyone, so that's, I wouldn't sell it as that, but can you imagine having that on your shoulders, that you're doing a movie about the movie that's supposed to be the best movie ever made?
I know. Well, I mean, that's one of the great things about it, and I think why, at least for me, why it's so successful is that it's not trying to imitate Citizen Kane. No. It's not, and it's not even about the making of Citizen Kane. And that's what, you know, before we really knew, that's kind of what, that was like our,
that was the story. Yeah.
That was the log line. And then we're like, oh, okay, cool. We're going to get to see all this behind the scenes stuff of the making of the movie. And that is not what it's about.
I mean, there's some loving send-offs to Citizen Kane when he drops his bottle of
yes, of
alcohol
course.
That looks exactly like the drop of the glass figurine there, whatever it is.
Yes, there are a few motifs, but not so many that it becomes like really cloying.
But in terms of Oscar, it's such an incredible race now in Best Actor. I thought Gary Oldman is phenomenal, but he's up against Chadwick Boseman for a posthumous Oscar for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, where he is terrific, as well as Anthony Hopkins in The Father, which I haven't seen. You've also said he does an incredible job as a man in the throes of dementia. What is this race? Tell me.
It's a really, really fun race. And yeah, Hopkins, and I said it when I first saw it, that this is a man with a 60 plus year career, and this is the best work of his life.
Wow.
And I can't even say that like hyperbole. It's just, I've never seen him do anything like what he does in this. And that is such a great sign, because there are plenty of actors that can fall back on certain types of behaviors and performances, and you feel very comfortable with it. And even to a certain extent, Hopkins had done that post like Amistad or something. And this was just in another realm. And you can say the same thing for Chadwick Boseman, even with a smaller career, but he has played these black icons, James Brown. And I mean, he was kind of like the go-to guy. And this gets to be a role and a character that feels so different and original for him. And he absolutely just eviscerates it.
So Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is a based on an August Wilson play about the day in the life of blues artist Ma Rainey and her band. It was actually one of my favorites this year. And Chadwick Boseman, he has two monologues. Mm-hmm. I was blown away, really.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's an outstanding film. And it's really interesting how many play to film adaptations we have this year. We're just talking about The Father and Ma Rainey, both plays that were adapted for film. And they,
One Night in Miami too, as well, right?
And One Night in Miami. And they all take slightly different approaches to it, where the majority of The Father is only in the apartment. The majority of Ma Rainey is just in the recording studio building. But does break out a little bit with the tents in Georgia scenes, and yeah, some street scenes. But I don't know if One Night Miami 2 also actually really expands out from the hotel room. I don't always think that a film adaptation has to do that, but I think sometimes the director will feel like they have to do it to avoid the quote unquote stagey comments and criticisms that play adaptations can get. And certainly, you know, any of the ones this year have been plagued by that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I really kind of push back on it because I enjoy the feeling of sometimes claustrophobia or locked in nature of a story that just is people talking in a room. You get to really kind of explore the cinematography of space in a room, the space between two characters.
Well, I thought Ma Rainey was so successful in terms of that, because also the colors, the sort of feel of the movie were so strong, and the fact that he has, or not just him, there's some incredible good monologues by Viola Davis as well. So the camera circling around, as you say, in this claustrophobic, and you really are looking at their faces when they're doing these monologues. I thought it was very successful played a movie.
Yeah, I think George Wolfe, who is a Tony winning Broadway director, did a fantastic job. I think I haven't done my predictions yet, but we'll see them in a few days. But I do think he is a top five contender this year.
I do too.
Which would be awesome.
And Fincher as well, of course, right?
Yes, of mm-hmm. course.
And Sorkin?
I'm not sure. I'm toying with a few, because, you know, it's early. It's only November, which is, you know, it's a different November than it would be.
Considering the Oscars are in April, it's a long
exactly, yeah. In a normal year. But I'm toying with a very different top five than I think most people.
Well, come on, tell us.
I think that Cornel Mondrusco has a fantastic chance of getting in for Pieces of a Woman. And I know that there are also some mixed feelings about that film, but not from my side. I think it's an extraordinarily directed film.
And Vanessa Kirby, who is the lead in that film, that she's a shoo-in for Best Actress, right?
Absolutely. She's like, right now, it's Viola, Francis, and Vanessa, really. Mm-hmm. Those are the three.
It's going to be an interesting year there. I mean, I've said it and I'll say it again. There's so many good movies in this very, very weird year. But let's talk about a movie that has getting a little bit mixed results. And that's Hillbilly Elegy, Ron Howard's movie, where we have two actresses, Amy Adams and Glenn Close, who between them have been nominated and lost more times than I don't know what. They really hold some sort of record. And I have the feeling that both of them were really hoping that this would be the movie at the right time. Tell me about the reactions to that.
So this was, you know, a best-selling novel, a semi-autobiographical book. And it was one of those on paper, you know, these roles are fantastic, and of course you can win an Oscar, but the reality of it is looking a little dreary. The response to it, I think the response to it was a little exaggerated. The hate for it, a little bit exaggerated. I think there hadn't been, I guess, a lot of really bad movies. So I think the knives were out and ready for one. And strangely enough, politics of the book from J.D. Vance are basically eliminated from the film. Mm-hmm. So there are almost no politics whatsoever to kind of zero in on or attack. But it didn't matter, because the reviews and the response was just so, so savage. I liked a lot of it. I liked a lot of the film. I think it is a gorgeous looking film. It's beautifully shot. It's beautifully scored. I like both Amy Adams and Glenn Close in it. And it's so funny because, as you know, Oscar watchers and film fans and, you know, lovers of actresses and crazy performances, you're not going to get more scenery chewing madness than this. And especially Amy Adams in it. You know, I mean, when was the last time that Amy Adams was shooting heroin in her foot, you know, in a truck stop bathroom? No, never. So you're only going to get to see that here.
Not since Enchanted.
I mean, exactly, really. So it's this weird...
But they really go for it. I mean,
Glenn Close, they really, really go for it.
You have to be prepared for, you know, from the wig to the, you know, it's a lot.
It is, and I think the movie would have been better served actually as only the stuff with Adams and Close and the younger J.D. Vance.
Right, I think
it did not need any of the. You know, him trying to get a job and going to Yale. That could have been a simple epilogue title card at the end.
Yeah, and the very meaningless girlfriend who's just sort of calling him on the phone all the time. I agree. I think there's certain things that could have been just taken away there.
Yeah, I think there was a more compelling story there because every time it left that, and it also plays with timing a lot, very unsuccessfully. I just didn't think it needed that.
No.
You know, if you were already going to remove all the politics out of it, then just remove him too.
Right. And in terms of Glenn Close, at the end of the movie, you see pictures of the real Mama, right. And you can see that it's absolutely identical. And she's really, you know, gone total method on her. I think it would have been well served if she would have taken that down just a little bit so that you weren't always thinking about, you know, not being able to actually feel because I was always looking at her performance.
I think she is served a little bit better than Adams in this because by comparison, Close is more subtle than Adams. Adams is at 11 at every single moment.
Yeah.
There are not a lot of variances in her performance, and that's not like a dig on her because I did like it. I liked seeing Adams do something so completely out of her wheelhouse. I like when any actor does, even if they're not successful at it. I will still applaud them for doing it, and Adams really does that here. So in comparison to Close. Close does feel like she is nurturing a performance, and she is the heart of this. She's the heart.
Yes, I would have wanted to see more of her and her
backstory. And the son. Yeah, I would have too, because we just get that little tiny bit of, you know, lighting her husband on fire, yeah. and the
everything is at 11 in this movie.
And I say that and then laugh because the tone of that moment. Is so really awkward.
Yeah. But in terms of, will they get nominated?
I think Glenn Close still does. I mean, I had her at number one for a long, long time because it was like one of the best good on paper predictions that you could make this year. And I mean, she's slowly kind of dropping down the list for me. I think it's going to be a bit of a struggle. Adams, I don't see a path for anymore.
Oh, they have the two of them with their nominations. There will be an Oscar one day.
I hope so.
Yeah. And I think Fincher may get his first Oscar, which is absolutely unbelievable that he doesn't have one at this point. But
maybe. We'll see.
Okay. I'm waiting for your list. So I just want to quickly mention there's two movies that I'm hearing so much buzz about that I have this prediction, see if you think I have any point in this, that will move up, be the sort of small movies that could. I know last time we talked about Minari, and I'm sure it's still up there, but I am hearing so much about Sound of Metal and Supernova.
So I've seen both of those, and I hope and I want Sound of Metal to be exactly that. I want it to be the little movie that could.
Tell us about what that's about.
Oh, my God. Riz Ahmed plays a drummer in a punk band who very quickly begins to lose his hearing. And the way that the film presents that, I think we've seen and heard a lot of movies that present deafness or being hard of hearing, you know, with muffled sounds and all of that kind of thing. We've seen that before. And that is in this as well, but it is such a complicated sound design in this movie, and the movie also provides subtitles so that we can obviously see what people are saying, but it's the bridge between the two for the viewer, between Riz Ahmed and, you know, anyone that he's talking to. Mm-hmm. But it's such a fantastic performance because it's also about addiction. It is about desperation. He's just an actor that has been building this fantastic repertoire, and he's already an Emmy winner, so he's not like a total unknown. He should be an Oscar nominee already for Nightcrawler. Mm-hmm. I do think he has an outstanding chance of getting in. I think Amazon is doing the right thing with it. It's gotten a lot of interviews, very specific interviews. There's the, you know, the actor interviews, and then there's the director sound designer interviews together, which is really, really smart. The sound categories this year are combined. They eliminated, you know, sound mixing and sound editing and have put them back together into one.
Well, this has to get in there, right?
I think it makes it a little more difficult. I think it makes it difficult for anybody because obviously there's half as many nominations that you can get. But yes, I think for a movie and a story that is so intrinsically about sound, I don't know how you wouldn't get that. Plus, there's a lot of big names behind it because Darius Marder, the director, his first feature, really was incredibly thoughtful about how the sound was going to be presented and who was going to do it. And I think Amazon is doing a fantastic job.
Well, hopefully we'll see how they can push Riz all the way over the top to get into a nomination.
I think so.
And what about Supernova? I'm hearing that Stanley Tucci could get a supporting.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've decided to do a lead supporting push, even though both Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci are co-leads. Mm-hmm. And it's a gay story as well. Between Carol and Brokeback Mountain, and almost any time that we see an LGBTQ relationship, when it comes to award strategy, there's a lot of dishonesty there, which is unfortunate. Meaning that it's easier to separate two co-leads in order to have a higher chance of getting nominations than it is to try and push two people in lead because
in the same category. Yeah.
Yeah. Two lead actor nominations or two lead actress nominations used to be really common and now are extremely, extremely rare, almost impossible. So they're just playing the odds, and I get it. I don't honestly have that many qualms with category fraud and all of that stuff when it comes to strategic awards planning. I just don't. But it does fall prey to LGBTQ stories quite often.
But why would it do that?
I don't know. It just does. It's not really that much more Colin Firth's story than it is Stanley Tucci's. I know you can make an argument that it is based on screen time, but it's really, really small. So I don't know. I'm a little on the fence about it.
Okay.
I'm a little on the fence. Okay, we'll see. But he's great. He's great.
And one other interesting thing is that Stanley Tucci, Anthony Hopkins, both play Alzheimer's dementia. And we could also have Dick Johnson.
Yeah.
Dick Johnson is dead in the documentary category, which also is about Alzheimer's. And there's definitely a theme here.
It is. And this is one of the kind of fascinating things about this is that we haven't really had... I mean, we've had some in the past. The Julie Christie movie was Away From Her,
right? And Julianne Moore.
It's becoming a little easier to talk about, I guess, than previously. I guess I'm glad for it. It is a subject that befalls many, many, many families. So I think it's great to explore. I think it's difficult to do as well without feeling either exploitative or, I don't know, maybe misrepresented. Because I think you can misrepresent certain types of ailments or diseases, autism or Asperger's or something, and then it starts to feel like weird actorly tics. And so I think maybe that might be part of the reason that that presenting dementia has been a difficult thing for movies to do, both delicately and respectfully.
Now, I haven't seen Hopkins yet in The Father. I understand from you that it's really...
Oh, my God.
But I thought that Dick Johnson was a very interesting and respectful and irreverent and in every way depiction mm-hmm. of dementia that I hadn't seen before.
That's a brilliant documentary.
So next time we talk, we can go into even more categories because we've covered a bunch here. But I just wanted, before I let you go, are there any other big themes that you're seeing in terms of the award race?
Well, even though Jennifer Hudson's Aretha Franklin movie dropped out entirely, you know, and moved to like August of 2021, there was this, we had three Black blues singers and R&B singer movies all happening at the same time with Ma Rainey and Respect when it was coming out in February. And the United States versus Billie Holiday with mm-hmm. Andra Day, which we are just starting to see little bits and pieces of. Vanity Fair had a fantastic exclusive piece with new images and photos that were absolutely gorgeous. Lee Daniels dropped a few of them on his Instagram. And so we're just kind of like, we're waiting. We want to see something. We want a teaser or a trailer.
And will that be out in time for this Oscars?
So it should be. I think it's going to be mid-February. It does have a UK release date to qualify for BAFTA and all that. So I don't see any reason why it wouldn't hear. That tipped the hand a little bit for that, mm-hmm. that it was going to be. But yeah, I think it's probably going to be mid-February.
Well, Eric, thank you so much. We're, you know, getting closer, even though it's much farther than usual.
it feels that way.
Yeah. It's like we're moving in some sort of Christopher Nolan Tenet, like.
That's exactly what it feels like. Yeah. That's a really good comparison.
All right. Well, thank you so much again and talk to you soon.
Absolutely.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes. Yeah. And you too.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.